It's 4 o'clock in Los Angeles. It's 6 o'clock in Chicago, and 7 p.m. in New York City. Hello, buddy. I'm Mad Dog DeCipio. Normally, you would hear me say, joined by Amelia the Pitbull Chapman, but Amelia is, she's indisposed tonight. She's actually getting over a really bad cold, and I was supposed to be joined tonight by our guest, Lou Ferranti, making his second appearance tonight. Lou has not, as of yet, showed up, so we will hold out to see if Lou pops up in the studio tonight. If not, I'm just hoping that the pit bull is listening to me right now. I'll hope you are, Amelia, because the Papa Bear is flying solo tonight. We were going to talk to Lou Ferranti about his brand new book, Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. Now, Lou has been here before, and he will be here again. In fact, in just a couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. But he was supposed to be here tonight. I don't know if Lou had a prior engagement he didn't remember he had, or if he is on a book tour, which is entirely likely given this book. It's a fascinating book. And if you haven't got, I got to tell you, just go get it. Go on Amazon.com. It's Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. This is book one in the trilogy. There are three books in this trilogy. This is the first one. Lou was going to be here to talk about the next two, but we'll just have to find out what happened to Lou and catch up with him. So, listen, since it's just us here tonight, how the hell are you? How is everybody? I hope you had a great weekend. It's been a somber weekend. Here's Lou.
How's it going, buddy?
There he is. Well, I just said to my audience, I said, folks, I was telling them about the book. I said, great. You can catch up on Amazon. It's Borgata, Rise of Empire. This is book one in the trilogy. I said, knowing Lou, he either forgot or he's on a road tour somewhere. So how are you, my friend?
Good, very good. And yourself?
Busy. I was just telling everybody, I had a kind of a somber weekend. We lost, my wife lost her uncle last night, and her co-worker's mother passed away yesterday morning.
Sorry.
So we had two in the same day. But, life goes on, as they say, Lou.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah.
But don't kill you makes you stronger.
I agree. Yeah.
I tell you what, I got this book. It arrived in the mail Saturday, and I haven't put it down.
Oh, great.
This is a hell of a book, brother. We got a lot to talk about. as Ricky Ricardo would say, you got some splaining to do, Lucy. Let's, first of all, I want to tell everybody, Borgata, Rise of Empire, History of the American Mafia. This is book one in the trilogy. Now, there are three books that will precede this. What I read here, if this is a precursor to the next two, boy, I'm going to tell you what, you've been a busy cat, brother. Because there's a lot of info in this book, a lot. And we're going to talk about a lot of it tonight. I want to tell everybody just some of the reviews that this and your other book, Mob Rules, is getting. This is from Mob Rules. Let me tell everybody. This is actually Borgata. Borgata is a detailed work that covers major events in American mafia history. The author produces some highly entertaining insights thanks to his background. Former mobster Lou Ferranti supplies a fascinating inside look at the history of the mafia. That's from the Wall Street Journal. My favorite one comes from Kirkus, and I love Kirkus. Ferranti draws on an extensive knowledge of world events, mob lore, and personal experience to deliver an engrossing effort that reads more like a rousing memoir, meditation on world history, and a mafia expose all in one. That's not bad coming from Kirkus, because they don't give out reviews like that, you know, to just anybody.
I agree. It's like pulling teeth. Now,
yeah, it's a hell of a review. It's one of my favorites. And I have, that's just two I read, Lou. And I've got a page and a half over here, brother. So we got some other, it spilled over onto the second page. There we go. So let's talk about Borgata. The name, where did Borgata come from?
The name comes from, we used to call it in the life, you would say you're with someone, let's say Angelo, you have your own crime family. We would say we're with Angelo's Borgata or his Brigade. You wouldn't say necessarily, you wouldn't use the term a crime family. So if somebody says, where's Louis from? He's with Angelo's Brigade or his Borgata. And the name originally comes from an Italian, like an Italian ghetto, close-knit people, neighbors, family, like the Spanish barrios or the Latin American barrios.
Yeah.
It would be the Borgata would be like the Italian neighborhood. And that's where it comes from. And then a family is like a close-knit, supposed to be a close-knit bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And it comes from that. So when I thought of it, I was using the term as I was writing. And I said, you know, this could be a good title for the whole trilogy, the Borgata trilogy. And Borgata Rise of Empire, Borgata Clash of Titans, Borgata Autumn of Empire. And I looked it up and nobody was using it. So I said, wow, that's great. Because typically, you know, you come up with a name, you check it out. Somebody's used it for something.
Yeah.
Other than the Borgata in Atlantic City casinos, you know, the casino in Atlantic City, nobody was using it and anything having to deal with this genre, this sort of writing. So
it's interesting that you brought up the Atlantic City casino.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing I thought of when I saw the book title was, in fact, the casino. And wondered if there was any connection. But now that you explain that, it makes perfect sense why the Borgata is called the Borgata.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone has any premise that organized crime has left Atlantic City, you're under a delusion.
Mm.
It's as strong today as it was 30 years ago.
Mm.
When or more than that, when the casinos came in, what, Lou? In
I think 79, they passed the laws.
I was going to say, so was it the 70s? I believe that, yeah.
Yeah, late 70s. I think
so. We're talking about some, you know, 30, 40 years now, right? 40
yeah.
years.
Yeah. What's interesting, 40,
No, 40 years, matter of fact.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about, you know, a presence that has been there for a long time, as it was in Las Vegas. Let's be honest. Let's be fair. Mm-hmm. There's enough blame to go around. Vegas, however, my understanding was founded by Benjamin Siegel, who I think if the story is right, he had this vision, Lou, of an oasis for where soldiers could kind of relax a little bit on the stopover cross country. People used to travel by trains a lot back in the day. And am I right about that? Isn't that where this began?
Yeah, it's very close to exactly what happened. Basically, the Hoover Dam, when they built the Hoover Dam, they needed to get men and material to the dam site. And the crossroads, the closest place that where people could go through to get to the dam site was through Las Vegas. And they used to, a lot of the workers used to then work at the dam site all week and then go to Vegas to drink and spend their money on women because they had obviously bordellos, they had gambling, they had liquor. And the dam site where the workers were housed it was during Prohibition. It was dry. There was no drinking allowed. They didn't need these guys to up on scaffolds drunk. So they wanted to keep them away from liquor for obvious reasons.
Sure.
And, so Siegel actually then after it starts to pick up speed, Vegas, and then it's put on hold during the war where soldiers do pass through there, just as you said.
Yeah.
But the building of Vegas was kind of put on hold. Everything was put on hold until we could win. The Allies could seek victory in the Asiatic Pacific and the European theater. After the war was over, that's when everyone started to flood in there. Now, Siegel wasn't the first to go there. There were a couple of other mob guys in and around Vegas, coming out of Chicago, coming out of New York. But Siegel really was the first to put it on the map. Yeah. When he said, you know, I want to build this Flamingo Hotel, and he started to get mob investors. And he had to convince Meyer Lansky, who was had a great name, great reputation with the mob. Once he knew he could convince Lansky, then Lansky was like the gold standard, his word. Lansky would in turn get everybody to invest in it. And that's basically how we got the investment. And I go through it in detail in the book because it's such a crucial part of the Italian-American mafia's experience in the United States, because they eventually controlled every casino hotel in Vegas. And it goes into volume two, where we'll see how they were able to get Teamster pension fund money to build more hotels in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of their relationship with Jimmy Hoffa and how it kept going.
I should tell the audience, Lou, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. I should tell the audience, mm-hmm. Lou Ferranti will be joining us again for his third of three appearances on the show. And we will talk about the Jimmy Hoffa, John Kennedy connection. We will talk about that precious, precious commodity called the Union Pension Fund. That Teamsters Fund was a veritable treasure trove of cash for the mob. And they had a very dear ally, a close friend in Jimmy Hoffa. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about where that all went wrong in that episode. But you mentioned the American Mafia, but which, by the way, in and of itself is a contradiction in terms. Mm-hmm. The Mafia is, by definition, an Italian name, an Italian thing, Cosa Nostra, mm-hmm. our thing. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, Lou, it always cracks me up when people say La Cosa Nostra, mm-hmm. because that would literally mean the our thing. Mm-hmm. It would literally mean the our thing. Mm-hmm. Where did La Cosa Nostra come from? Who decided to put the La on it?
Yeah, I'm not sure how they put that on, but it does originate in Sicily. They felt like it was their thing, their exclusive thing. Yeah. And it came to America, and they picked it up more and more in America. Mm-hmm. In Sicily is where the whole thing began, and I go through that also too deeply in the book. I wanted to know, when I started writing this history, I read a lot of books that they'll tell you, well, the mafia came from Sicily, or they'll tell you the mafia sort of stemmed from feudalism. And there's usually a word or two about it, and then they move on. And they leave me with more questions than they've answered. And I was very frustrated. Yeah. When I want to read a book, let's say, about the Roman Empire, I become very frustrated if they start with Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar. Mm-hmm. I want to know what created that man, what created that Caesar. Yeah.
I love that inquisitive nature. I'm the same way. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things is to dissect history. Mm-hmm. To see, I by nature, I'm a guy that likes to take things apart and see how they work. Mm-hmm. And I do that with history as well. I want to see how it works. Let's talk about Sicily. Let's talk about the Moors invading Sicily. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how we Italians ended up being fairly olive complected when we weren't before. Mm-hmm. People don't understand that, you know, Italians are genetically fair-skinned people, mm-hmm. with blonde hair and blue eyes, like you would see in Idaho or someplace like that. We are not inherently dark-skinned people. We became so through attrition. We were invaded in Sicily by the Moors that spread throughout Italy. You know, it's like Lou, it's a chain event. You know, one copulates with another and one family enters another. And before you know it, you've got all these, you know, mixed breed people in there. Mm-hmm. But they made some beautiful babies.
Yeah, yeah, Italians are some of the most good-looking people in the world. You know,
we are completely biased on that. So tell the audience, Lou.
Not myself included. I just mean the people I know, people I've seen in Italy, sure. The Italian Americans I've known. Yeah. A lot of the women and men, you know, actors and actresses, et cetera. I realized that I never knew until I started doing deeper research. You know, my grandmother, my father's parents were from Bari. My mother's father was from Naples and her mother was from Sicily. So I'm a bit of a mutt, right. All Italian, but different parts of Italy. And my grandmother, who's Sicilian, is very dark, probably darker than a lot of African-Americans I know. She was very dark. And there's a combination of why we are, most of the Northern Italian people in my family, my Aunt Mary married my Uncle Tony, who was from Northern Italy, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, as you said. A lot of the Northern Italians are more fairer-skinned. A lot of the Southern Italians are darker. And there's two reasons. One is the sort of like the Mediterranean bronze-skinned people that come from Southern Italy. Yeah. And also, just as you said, Southern Italy, as well as Sicily, which was sort of categorized as part of Southern Italy, they have been invaded from the North Africans and all different types of peoples throughout the ages. They have Arabs. Arabs were there for quite some time. The Spanish were there for quite some time. So even my own name, Ferrante, King Ferrante of Naples, was originally King Ferdinand from Spain. Yeah. And then became King Ferrante. And so even the name comes from Spain. So we are, we're the original Latins, which people fail to realize in America today.
Absolutely. You know,
most people don't realize that. But it's interesting too, that there is so many different peoples that are intermixed with our bloodline. As Southern Italians for the most part, but all Italians. And I didn't realize that until I got deep into the research. And then I started talking to friends of mine who have done ancestry stuff and, you know, genealogical tests and stuff. Yeah. And they found themselves to be either a percentage from Africa, a percentage from Middle East, a percentage from, you know, different places all over the world, which intrigued them. And they said, wow, you know, and it's because Italy was always sort of like the crossroads of empires.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I did my family tree, I found I was the direct descendant of Aurelius Scipio, who was the lead general in the Carthaginian War. He teamed with a guy whose name was Hannibal.
Yeah. At the time. He beat Hannibal.
And I found out what my name literally means. It means the word Scipio is from the word cipollone, which is an onion. If people don't understand that, a cipollone is an onion. So my name literally means of the onion field, which is interesting because my entire family's in the food industry.
Well, that's funny because Ferrante, Ferra is iron. And my grandfather worked with iron when he came here.
And that's something?
In Italy.
Let's talk about the migration from the old world to the new one. It's an interesting story you lay out. And without tipping the hat, without giving too much of the book away, because I want people to buy it, give them the Reader's Digest version, Lou, of how this happened, they ended up the American Mafia.
Yeah, so when the United States abolished the terrible institution of slavery in the 1860s. Yeah, the Civil War is over by 1865. Slavery is subsequently abolished. And now the Southern plantations, for the most part, but all of the United States, is in desperate need of workers, especially the South to replace the slave labor. But we're also an up-and-coming industrial society, and we need workers to fill those jobs. And at the same time, around the same time, Italy was unified. And when Italy was unified, Italy was always different city-states. You had Venice, you had Florence, you had it was always Tuscany. You had all these different city-states up and down the peninsula of Italy, the boot. And all of a sudden in the 1860s, because of Giuseppe Mazzini and Cavour, Count Cavour, Italy is united and becomes one nation. And when that happened, Sicilians were sort of lumped into it, and they were dragged into it, and they were lied to. They didn't want to be part of Italy. They felt it was their latest overlord. We had enough. We've been ruled by the Romans, the Greeks, the Spanish, the French, the Arabs. You know, we're tired of it. We don't want it anymore. We want to be independent. But they were sort of hoodwinked into it, and that's a deeper conversation. But most Sicilians I knew, even growing up, thought of themselves. If you said to my grandmother, I'd say, you know, Nana, you know, you're Italian in some form of conversation. She would say, no, I'm not. I'm Sicilian. Ooh.
Yeah. I know people. Lou, I got news for you, brother. I know people today that don't call me Italian. I'm Sicilian.
That's right. That's right. So,
and that bloodline means something. Mm-hmm. And it means something directly to the mafia. Mm-hmm. You, right. The true mafia, in order to be a quote member of the mafia, you have to have Sicilian blood. That was the rule for the longest time.
In the beginning, that's correct. And then at some point, they loosened it up and said, just Italian blood is enough. So you could be from Calabria, you could be from even Northern Italy. But originally, as you said, it was just Sicilian blood. And I go through the initial war, which was between two Sicilian factions who did not like each other in the United States. And they had a war. And desperate for soldiers, they had to recruit Italians outside of Sicily who were here, Italian-Americans, other Italian-Americans, a lot of Napolitans, Neapolitans were brought into the ranks and stuff. But getting back to the original, when Italy was unified and Sicily was unhappy, and then Italy was sort of like a poor new country. And a lot of the Sicilian Sicilians and a lot of the Southern Italians, being from Naples or Calabria, they saw an opportunity in America because America was desperate for labor. So there were these huge immigrant waves into the United States. And along with these massive immigrant waves came the mafiosos, fugitives from justice, some of them just rode in with the wave looking for a new opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then what they did was they sort of like piggybacked on the backs of hardworking Italian Americans because their work ethic, the Italian Americans, time and again, other ethnicities praised the Italian Americans for having the hardest work ethic. And they said, they're like mules on working on a farm. It's incredible what the Italian American could do in a day. You know, I'll need two workers to make up for what one Italian can do. Yeah. And because of that, they dominated the waterfront. They dominated fruit and vegetable markets. They dominated industries like the garment center. And because of their dominance in those areas, because of their hard work ethic, the mafiosos need only then kind of like ride in behind them and organize them into a workforce where you could say, well, if all the Italians are going to work for me through threats, through bribes, through whatever, and they're working for me and I'm organizing them and mobilizing them, I could shut down the waterfront in an hour and everything that's coming in is perishable. All the fruit, vegetables, fish. So I could shut down an industry with a nod of the head. And that's how the mafiosos gained a lot of power through the hardworking Italian immigrants.
Lou, how quickly a process was it from the time of arrival to where they had a stronghold on industry here?
So they started to really, really, the strong immigrant waves, it started after the Civil War, but it started getting heavy towards the end of the 19th century, the late 1800s is when it really became a lot of, several million people came in. And then with lightning speed, the mafia started to creep up everywhere. And they would sort of like throughout cities across the country, there were 24 borgatas or mafia families in 24 metropolitan cities across the United States.
Wow.
So, this is incredible with lightning speed. And they were sending letters to each other saying, look out for Gino, he's on his way. Look out for Nino, he should be there tomorrow. Look out for Pino, he got there yesterday, and so on and so forth. So they constantly looked out for each other and they would sort of like spread out across the country with the Italian, hardworking Italian Americans who were only looking for work. You know, they went where they knew if you're a mobster, you're not going to get far if you go tell a bunch of Germans or Irish, I want to take over the waterfront. They're going to kill you and throw you in the water.
If
you go there and all the Italians are hardworking and you say, look, you know me. Hey, Paisan, what's going on? He's one of us. Okay, if we get together and we stand together, just follow my lead. And whether they wanted to, sometimes somebody would speak up and say, I don't want to be part of this. And then they were muscled into it or they left or they were fired and they sort of weeded out the Italians who didn't want to be part of it. Mm-hmm. I know an Italian American family who was in the waste removal business in the very early 20th century, three generations ago. And they knew that the mob had infiltrated that so deeply that they didn't want to be part of that. So they went to another state and started, so there were Italian Americans who ran away from it, but the mafia still kept pushing forward until they dominated a lot of industries.
Yeah, people don't understand that. The whole Tony Soprano thing being in the waste removal business, that's not just a show plot. And that's mm-hmm. real life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People don't understand that. I would venture to say that in the state of New Jersey, where I live, 100% of probably 100% of all waste removal is mafia controlled. I don't have a problem saying that. Mm-hmm. Probably in New York as well. Probably a good 80 to 90% mm-hmm. is all mob controlled. Why did we as a people allow them to have that kind of power?
To give the mafia credit, and I don't want to be misconstrued with my words, but to give the mafia some credit where it's due, at a time when the industry was chaotic, mm-hmm. the mafia did step in. For example, I have a friend of mine who controlled all of the waste removal in Long Island at one point or another. Mm-hmm. And he was eventually charged with running a quote unquote cartel. And it was, they said the mafia was controlling all of the garbage on Long Island. Were they controlling the garbage? To some extent, yes, they did control it. But what did they do exactly? Well, they organized territories. So if let's say you, Angelo, had 4 or 5 trucks and me, Louis, from over there has 6 trucks. Instead of us stepping on each other's toes and fighting over different territories, they would say, Angelo, this is your territory. Louis, this is yours. Joey, this is yours. Frankie, this is yours. And then there were also non-Italians who were part of this quote-unquote cartel. You had a German guy, you had an Irish guy, you had a Welshman, you had all different types of people who wanted to start businesses, and they were allowed to participate. They were treated equally, and they weren't allowed to undercut each other because they wanted to control the pricing. The mob did. So they would say to you, Angelo, you got to stop charging people $5 a ton less than Louis, because people are running to you, and then it's becoming imbalanced and there's going to be chaos. We can't have everybody doing that. So the mob, to their credit, once again, I'm not excusing the violence they did to keep this cartel going. I'm not excusing any type of racketeering charges that were probably valid. But I will say this, everybody was allowed to eat from this pie while my friend was in control of that waste management on Long Island. At some point or another, I won't name the company, a giant corporation with the help of the government pushed out all of the mob guys. And then what happened was slowly but surely that giant corporation bought up all of the small outfits like yours, mm-hmm. like mine, like Joey's, like Nino's, and so on and so forth. And once like O'Reilly, like O'Flanagan, even the other non-Italians. Yeah. And slowly but surely that one company dominated the industry, where a guy like you or a guy like me now can't compete with that big company because they're so big and they put us out of business. So now your kids can't eat, my kids can't eat, but we did eat when the mob was controlling it. So to their credit, the mob's credit, I will say this, I'm not excusing their conduct in the way of violence or any type of racketeering charges that were valid, as I said, but I will say this, who's the real mafia? If a big corporation owns it now, and you and I can't start up a little company with 3 or 4 trucks, but the mafia allowed us to.
Yeah.
Who's the real mafia? Is it the big corporations?
Of course. Mm-hmm. You'll not get an argument from me. I've been making the argument for years, Lou, mm-hmm. you know, that the mob has nothing on the government.
Right.
Because that's real organized crime. And when I say real organized and real crime, brother, mm-hmm. the government doesn't, you don't hold a candle to that level of organized crime.
That's right.
You can't compete on that level. Mm-hmm. So what's it going to hurt to let a guy, you know, as they say in The Godfather, wet his beak a little?
Yeah.
You know, it's mm-hmm. not going to hurt anybody.
That's
and
right.
Maybe, you know, he might do something good, make a few dollars for his family.
Right.
Let's talk about that very subject, mm-hmm. earning money in the mafia. Mm-hmm. I'm listening the last couple of days to a lot of people, guys like Michael Franchese, Sammy Gravano, Joey Merlino, who, by the way, former mob boss of Philadelphia, who now has his own podcast. Are you ready for this shit? He's got his own podcast. It's crazy stuff. I'm listening to people like Larry Mazza and John A. Light and, you know, a bunch of people like that. And they all say the same thing. They all say the same thing. They've taken away, they've, whoever they is, they've taken away our ability to earn. Who is they, and how much are we talking about in earnings, Lou?
So, you know, you really can't, there's always guesstimates. you know, Fortune 500 magazine came out with a story back in the 80s, and they tried to guess what the mob bosses were worth and what the industry was worth. But nobody could ever really pinpoint it. Even in my own case, mm-hmm. the prosecutors would try to say they stole millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, they throw around figures. So a big mob guy once said to me in the very beginning when I was kind of coming into the world, coming into the life, he said to me, look, when you read in the newspapers about all the money and all the killings and let me tell you something, just so you know, all of that money that they tribute to us is bullshit. All of the murders is true. That's what he said to me. Yeah. So he did make it clear. But there is millions involved, and the government did take away a lot of it. Rudolph Giuliani, when he was mayor of New York, he had so if you looked at it from if you look at one part of it, he was able to run the mob out of a lot of different industries, and that was probably a good thing. But who went and filled the vacuum might have been a bad thing. So, like I said, if you run the mob out of the South Street Seaport or off the waterfront, okay, that's fine. If you're going to have a legitimate sort of like equality where anybody has a chance there to make it, then I'm in agreement with it. Fine. As a citizen today, I'm not in the mob. Run them out and let the small guys get a piece of this pie. Let the small guys move up where they might not have been able to. But if you tell me that a giant corporation then, you know, from based in Canada or based mm-hmm. in Europe is now taking over where we ran the mob out, and the people are less satisfied with the new management than they were with the mob, then here's the problem. I was away with Anthony Calagna. Anthony Calagna, he's dead now. I could talk about him. Anthony Calagna was a big union guy, and he used to negotiate huge contracts for his workers. And he was in prison with me too. And I says, Ant, you know, you don't seem like a crooked guy to me. He was a brilliant guy. You know, he had schooling. He was intelligent.
Right.
And he goes, Lou, you know, I'll be honest with you. I rose up through the union. When I took over my post, it was sort of like all of the envelopes came to my desk. It was built into the position. And I had no choice but to turn, you know, you can't turn them away. There's things that are happening. And when he left, when the government took him out of circulation and put him in prison, they replaced him with a government-appointed union leader. And that government-appointed union leader was so bad that and so ignorant of what mm-hmm. what needed to be done to help the people, the workers, the courts were flooded with letters from every average worker. And Anthony assured me that none of them were prompted by him. The courts were flooded with letters going, please give us Anthony Calagna back. Get rid of this government guy. The union is not being run correctly. We miss this. We need that. So that was how, and we'll talk about it, like you said, when we get to it with Hoffa.
Yeah.
But that was Hoffa, why Hoffa was a gem and why he had almost like unanimous loyalty within the Teamsters, because he did a lot for the workers. And even if he made deals with the mob, what deals did he make that was so bad? He did
exactly.
real estate deals that he made money on. So
the book is Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. This is book one in the trilogy series. The author is Louis Ferranti. Lou, you have the unique distinction of being a guy that can speak on this subject, and only you can speak on this subject. Your boss, at your late boss, Mr. John Gotti, became a powerful man because someone had to die for him to get there. That person was Mr. Paul Castellano. Now, Paul Castellano, by all admission, I think, and anybody with any sense of or history of the mafia will understand, Paul Castellano was, they called him the banker. He was a money guy, but he wasn't a street guy. He was a guy who dined at fancy restaurants and always wore a suit and tie, and that's who he was. John Gotti was a street guy. And it's a strange thing to say, Lou, but how did a street guy end up making more money than the alleged so-called banker? How did that happen?
Yeah.
So more money and less bloodshed, by the way, Lou. I don't know if you know this or not. I did some research. Mm-hmm. John Gotti took over, and there was less bloodshed under John Gotti than in the previous 18 to 20 years before him.
No one ever says what you just said, and it's exactly right. And that's exactly 1,000% right. And if you were to deduct the murders that Sammy the Bull Gravano was responsible for, John Gotti almost killed no one. I mean, that's really the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and compared to not only Paul Castellano, who killed matter-of-factly, like it was nothing. And I knew people who knew Castellano firsthand in his house. And, you know, we all know now from books and et cetera, he was a killer. But not only him, even Carlo Gambino killed very easily.
Oh, sure.
Carlo Gambino didn't think twice either. If he thought he had any reason to fear you, you know, he looked like an old grandfather, Carlo Gambino, like a nice little old man. He had like a little smile on his face. He was very frail.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't, people were terrified of him.
And can I tell you something, Lou? I met him twice.
Oh, that's interesting.
I met him twice.
That's interesting.
And both times, the first time I shook his hand, the second time he gave me a hug.
Yeah. Yeah. I understood.
And that's a true story. And I will not tell anyone, not then or to this day, and beyond this day, I will never tell anyone why I was there to see him, but I will suffice it to say he's gone now. That was then, this is now. And you're right. He looked like somebody's grandpa.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And he did not, you'd never mistake him for like a Marlon Brando, Don Corleone type.
Oh God, no.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. You'd probably think first he should be like handing out lemon ices or, you know, at the corner of, you know, like his son owns a pizzeria and he doesn't know what to do with his father or his grandfather. That's what.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the power that old man wielded.
Well, he was extremely powerful. Carlo Gambino knew how to gain and maintain power. And that was his expertise. He was absolutely brilliant when it came to that. And if you never lose sight of that power, those are the people who stay in power for the longest and obviously become the biggest and dominate the most. Guys who lose sight of it, whether it be John Gotti's ego, whether it be someone else's greed, whether it be certain people make major mistakes and their character flaws lead to their own downfall.
Yeah.
Carlo Gambino did not have those character flaws. If you do like a sort of like an analytical sort of like a study of his character, you would find almost like the perfect specimen to run a mafia family, almost like right out of the movie screen by Francis Ford Coppola, Don Corleone, maybe even better than Corleone because Corleone had a soft spot for Sonny Corleone. So not even him. So, you know, I mean, he was an incredible earner from when he was young.
Yeah.
As sort of like as nondescript as he was, he figured out how to get to the top spot. Big part of it was, though, he had a lot of blood in the family.
And oh, God, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Own brothers were captains, his nephews, his cousins.
Yeah.
He brought people over from Sicily. So the Gambino crime family was saturated with literally members of the Gambino and Castellano clans, which were both part of the Gambino blood family. And that sort of was a big part of it.
You mentioned character study. Let's talk about character study. I pulled four characters from American mafia lore. I want to talk about these four guys. And in no particular order, Lou. Al Capone, Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, and Joe Valachi.
Okay.
Let's talk about Valachi first, I guess.
Okay.
He's the guy most famous. People have heard and seen, of course, they've read the book, The Valachi Papers. You may have even seen the movie, The Valachi Papers. Mm-hmm. Tell everybody who Joe Valachi was and why he was such an interesting character study, mafia-wise.
Yeah, so it's a great question because he played such a big role in mobdom. And he sort of takes, for a while, he takes center stage in volume two of the Borgata trilogy, which by the way, your listeners can pre-order now on Amazon as well. It should be due out this year. It will be due out this year. Will be out. So part two, volume two, Valachi plays a role. And Valachi was part of the Genovese family. Vito Genovese sort of was a Neapolitan, a Napoli Don, as we would say. And he had a lot of Napoli Dons in his Borgata, in his crew. and Valachi was an obligado. So he was sort of part of that crew. He was never a big earner, but he did a lot of work, meaning he killed people. At some point or another, Genovese had an idea that Valachi snitched, and they were in prison together, and he ordered his murder. And I don't want to go too deep into it because I unravel a lot of mystery in volume two. But I will say that eventually he had to kill somebody, Valachi. He gets caught. He goes in front of he wants to get out of it. He doesn't want to do a murder bit. And he thinks that Genovese wants to kill him. So he says, let me snitch. And he becomes an informant. And Bobby Kennedy, who's the attorney general at the time, seized on this because he wanted to prove to the American people that the mafia was real, that it existed throughout the country. And now all of a sudden he brings Joe Valachi before a Senate committee and he has him testify. And he's grilled by senators and he's asked all kinds of questions about La Cosa Nostra. And he starts to tell about the oath he took. And he talks about the structure of a mafia family, which is very much like the Roman legions. And he talks about capo regimes for the first time. And a lot of this sort of the American public swallowed it wholesale. I mean, they've never heard this stuff before.
Oh, yeah.
This is long before the Godfather movie. So Valachi is the first real informant. That, you know, open informant. Now, we didn't know this until later that J. Edgar Hoover did have confidential informants he was already conferring with in the underworld.
Yeah.
But nobody knew about that, including Bobby Kennedy, who wasn't told about that. So
one of those people, by the way, Lou, and we should, in the interest of full disclosure, we should tell people that one of those informants, very close informant to J. Edgar Hoover, intimately so, was Johnny Roselli.
Yes.
Johnny Roselli, it can be said now, was J. Edgar Hoover's boyfriend.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
Well, we know that historically now.
Yeah, really? So that's...
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I didn't...
Freedom of Information Act, yeah.
Oh, wow. So I'd love to see that. I'm gonna research it now that you said it in case I got to
add it. They had a kind of a tryst.
Yeah.
The best word to use.
Uh-huh.
That's factual. I had to check it. I didn't want to say anything, you know, out of school here.
Mm-hmm.
So, cause we do our research, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things though, and in fact, talking about Johnny Roselli and J. Edgar Hoover, we have to, at least peripherally, Lou, we have to talk about the relationship between those two as it relates to John Kennedy, just peripherally, what was the associate? Why did Hoover, and for that matter, Johnny Roselli, why did they hate John Kennedy so much? Did they have a personal beef or what?
There's a lot of components in this and it's very interesting. And I cover it briefly in volume one and thoroughly in volume two. And basically what happens is I cover in volume one, why Hoover did not want to go after the mob. And in volume two, I cover more so the feud with Kennedy. And what happened was Frank Sinatra was sort of a liaison between the mob and the Kennedy administration before Kennedy was actually in office, the Kennedy campaign. Mm-hmm. And Sinatra loved, you know, Kennedy liked hanging out with Sinatra. And Sinatra was always around beautiful women and Kennedy liked women. We all know now.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of gravitated towards Sinatra, always hanging out with him. And Sinatra owed the mob favors from when he was young coming up.
Sure.
Moretti out of Jersey used to make him sing in his clubs. He helped him get out of contract with Tommy Dorsey. So there was a lot of things that Sinatra liked hanging out with the mob and owed them. So at some point or another during the Kennedy campaign, Joe Kennedy, who was funding John F. Kennedy's campaign, Joe Kennedy being the father of John, Joe Kennedy Sr., he knows he needs a lot of the swing states, like, for example, the Chicago, a lot of the wards that were controlled in Chicago by the mob. He's going to need them to vote John Kennedy. And he starts reaching out through Sinatra to Sam Giancana, who was the acting boss of the Chicago mob. He starts reaching out to the New York mafiosos, the bosses, saying, help us in New York and also help us with money. We need money. As much money as Joe Kennedy had, the more donations, the more people want to contribute, the better.
So Joe Kennedy
strikes a deal with the mob, and he's basically speaking on behalf of his son. I don't believe John Kennedy was guilty of these alliances. I believe Joe Kennedy was. And John Kennedy sort of like had that attitude always throughout his life. I don't know. Ask Dad. I don't know. Dad's taking care of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is dad tells me what to do. I do it. Dad told me to run for president when my older brother died. So I'm running. Here I am. You know, so I don't think John was more of a happy-go-lucky, innocent type character inside, right. You know, notwithstanding his faults like we all have.
Oh, sure. But
he wasn't as devious as Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy made all these alliances and sort of promised the mob, look, when my son's in, he'll leave you alone. You just do what you want to do. I promise you that. John Kennedy gets in with the mob's help. Not all the mob. Some of them didn't want Kennedy. They went with Nixon. But the majority of the mobsters who knew Frank Sinatra went with Kennedy, helped him get in, dumped money into the West Virginia primary, which was a crucial win for Kennedy. He needed it.
Oh, absolutely.
And at some point or another, he gets into the Oval Office. He appoints Robert Kennedy Attorney General. And Robert Kennedy had a long-standing feud with the mob. And he starts going after them. And I think Joe Kennedy would have intervened had he not had a stroke early on. And once
I have a question in that regard, because I knew we were going to go there. Mm-hmm. I have a question in that regard. Why didn't John just tell Bobby, stand down, back off?
You know, I this same question you asked, I've asked a million times.
He's the president of the United States, and it's his brother.
I don't think he was able to control him, and I think he relied on him too much, and I think Bobby was too headstrong, because I've asked it a million times. Why didn't Jack just say, enough now? That's enough now, Bobby. Stand down.
And if you want to get down to it, I think Bobby's responsible for John being killed, not Lee Harvey Oswald.
1,000,000% true. And Bobby thought he was responsible. How about that?
Oh, he said it. Yeah, he's on record as having said it.
That's right.
He said, I think my decisions cost my brother his life.
That's 100% right, Ange.
Lou, there are two guys of the four that I mentioned. There are two of them that have been inextricably linked throughout mob lore. Mm-hmm. Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano.
Yes.
Can we explore their relationship? How did these two guys even get together?
Yep. So as you know, I covered it thoroughly in volume one, and it was a fascinating alliance between two men who were opposites and yet the same. And they meet when they're young kids on Hester Street in Lower Manhattan, and they become fast friends. Meyer Lansky actually stood up to Luciano, who was a little bit of a bully. Luciano went to bully him. Lansky said, F you, I don't take shit from nobody. And Luciano said, you know what? I like this kid's chutzpah. I'm gonna take him under my wing, and we'll see what we could do together.
He's got balls,
big balls, and they became fast friends. Yep. And as they got older, I feel that Luciano had his foot in the mob. Lansky didn't. As a Jew, he wasn't able to become a made member of the mafia. Luciano was, but Meyer Lansky sort of stage managed Luciano's career in so many different ways. And he was an absolute brilliant numbers guy. He read big money, and anything he touched turned to gold within the underworld. So Luciano was always making money. Now, to Luciano's credit, although Lansky was the big earner, Lansky may have stage managed Luciano's career. Luciano was the actual boss.
Yeah.
And he had the wherewithal to listen to him, number one. And number two, he never was greedy with him. Luciano allowed Lansky to make money with everybody. As long as Luciano got a piece of it, he was happy. Instead of saying, a lot of dumb mob guys would say, no, he's my guy. Sorry, Ange, you can't do that with him. Sorry, you're not allowed to work with Maya. He's my guy. And I know a lot of greedy people from the streets and even today who would have that same vision. Luciano's vision was definitely more enlightened than all of them, where he would say, go for it, Maya. If you could pull it off, if you could go to Cuba and build hotels, bring all the mob guys there that you can. Let them all earn. And as long as Luciano, he was part of Luciano's Borgata. People fail to realize that. Luciano had a claim on him.
Yeah.
Fido Genovese.
Well, the mob, you talk about Cuba. The mob owned Cuba.
That's right.
They owned Cuba up until, you know, right after the Castro regime, in fact.
That's right.
And even during it. Because Castro, let's just be honest, you know, Castro was making money too.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for a little while. That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they had an interesting relationship, these two guys. Yeah. Without giving too much of the book away, there's a story that takes place in Italy at the airport concerning Lucky Luciano.
Mm-hmm.
Tell everybody what happened there.
Well, he towards the end of his life, he's deported. He's in prison for a long time. Mm-hmm. And at some point, he helps the United States Navy, U.S. Naval Intelligence, secure the waterfront during World War II, which was a crucial step, a crucial measure that they desperately needed. U.S. Naval Intelligence was fearful that Nazi submarines were patrolling out there off the coast. And they were. A couple of them were caught. One off the coast of Long Island, another one somewhere was caught. I forget now off the top of my head. But they caught a couple of Nazi submarines. And then there was a ship that belonged to the French that was parked in on the New York piers. And that ship was, instead of giving it back to the Vichy French government after the Nazis took over France, mm-hmm. Hitler, the United States said, we'll just keep the ship. It was originally the USS Normandy. They rechristened it the USS Lafayette after the colonial Civil War hero. I'm sorry, Revolutionary War hero who fought with Washington. So they rename it the USS Lafayette, and the Lafayette is burned in New York Harbor. And they all believe it. Everybody believed at first it was sabotage. Eventually the Navy said, well, it wasn't, but a lot of people still believed even after the Navy cleared that theory.
Yeah.
And they said, well, if it's sabotage, whether the U.S. Navy believed it was or wasn't when they cleared it of that, they still believe that it could happen whether it did or didn't. And they needed the Italian-American mafia to secure the waterfront so that it didn't happen again or wouldn't happen if it was sabotage.
Yeah.
And they said, basically, they got in bed with this guy, Joe Sox Lanza. So Joe Sox was controlling the waterfront on behalf of Luciano. And Joe Sox says, look, my boss is in Clinton Dannemora, a prison where I was at one point myself. But mm-hmm. he said, he's up in Clinton Dannemora. If you get word to him, let him give me the okay. Otherwise, they'll kill me. I can't work with the government. You know, these other mob guys will hear I'm working with the government. They'll clip me. Go to my boss. So they go to Luciano and they tell him, look, we want to work with, we want Sox Lanza to help us. And we want to work with the Navy. And, you know, the Navy's going to work with the mob. Keep the waterfront okay. He says, fine. So in the end of the war, for his help, Governor Dewey acquitted him, gave him commutation. Mm-hmm. Let him out of prison, but on the condition that he be deported back to Italy. So they sent Luciano back to Italy. Now he's living out the last of his days over there, and he's a little broke. He's getting a little check from Vito Genovese, who eventually took over after taking over through Frank Costello, which is an interesting intrigue in the book. I urge everyone to read it.
But
eventually Genovese.
He was the character, Frank Costello.
Big time. Yeah, he was great. He controlled Tammany Hall, had Tammany Hall in his pocket. So at some point, Luciano's in Italy, and he wants to write a movie and a book about his life, and Genovese sends a guy there to tell him, no, dead, you're not allowed to. And he says, get the script, we want to read it. I'm taking it back with me to New York. So Luciano calls the guy he's writing the script with, a producer. He's in Spain. He says, get on a plane, come to see me in Italy right away. When the guy gets there, unfortunately for Luciano, he's so worked up over this, and he has a massive heart attack in the airport. And that's sort of like the exit of... And Lucky Luciano was the Augustus Caesar of this era.
Yeah.
He was the guy who really made a lot of it happen. He was a central character throughout the book. And there he is. He exits towards the end of volume one. I hope I didn't give too much of a spoiler away, but it's still...
Oh, no. I'll tell you what. That's perfect. That's a perfect segue. The last guy on the list actually has a house 3 minutes up the street from where I live right now.
Mm.
I live... exactly 3 minutes from Al Capone's summer home.
Oh, wow.
In Clementon, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sprawling estate. It's the biggest house in town.
Mm-hmm.
It just sold for $3.75 million today,
mm-hmm.
in today's money. Mm-hmm. Al Capone, there's a placard there and everything, Lou.
Mm-hmm.
Former home of Al Capone.
Interesting.
I want to talk about Al for about 6 minutes because we've got about 7 minutes left. Let's talk about Al Capone and his legacy, mm-hmm. his aura, the lore surrounding this larger than life, short little fat guy named Al Capone.
Okay. Well, first I want to apologize to anyone viewing us tonight. Darkness fell. I didn't have a light on, so I'm more and more in the dark in my room, just so you know. But Al Capone.
Believe it or not, it adds to the ambiance.
There you go.
Perfect.
That's right.
So it's all good with me, brother.
Yeah, and I'm getting better looking by the minute, right? In the dark.
There you go.
So Now Al Capone was a guy, Nobbly Don, grows up in Brooklyn, really big family guy, loves his family, loves his friends, loyal like you can't imagine, old school loyalty. And at some point or another, cuts a guy, gets into a beef with another guy, he's got to go to Chicago. They send him to Chicago. In Chicago, he's groomed by some of the biggest guys there. Johnny Torrio takes a liking to him, and big Jim Calamiso, but mostly Johnny Torrio takes a liking to him and brings him up in the mob in Chicago. And Capone now became a really, really big figure during bootlegging years, during Prohibition. And basically he said, look, I'm just giving the American people what they want. Don't look at me. Don't blame me. The demand is there, and I provide the supply. Don't blame me. So time and again, I feel if you read the quotes from Al Capone, things he said to people, things he said to reporters, things he said to prosecutors, things he said to fellow gangsters, he comes across as a brilliant guy, not book smart, not an intellectual, but a guy who understood human nature. And he even gave advice to a reporter who was banging on doors, trying to, unravel corruption in the highest levels of government and stuff. Yeah. And he told the guy, back off. He goes, you're up against a machine that's a lot bigger than you, but somebody has to. And he said, you're going to find yourself in trouble. And I think the guy did. He ended up dead. You know, Capone, he was like a brilliant guy. He understood human nature. He understood the bigger machine. He understood supply and demand. He understood the American public's pulse like no one else did. Mm-hmm. And he was able to really hone in on all of that and capitalize on it as a mob boss.
He really was, in a lot of ways, Lou, the American Robin Hood, because he gave a lot of money away.
Soup kitchens, that's right.
Yeah. People don't understand the good that he did. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're going to talk about that in your next appearance here briefly, and then we're going to get into Kennedy and Hoffa. Mm-hmm. Brother, I want to tell you what, that was the fastest hour I ever had on this show.
All right, so it was great.
Always a fascinating a chain of events when you're here. The stories are, when you talk about mob lore, the stories, it's all about the stories. Mm-hmm. People don't believe that this stuff really happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really did, folks. It really did. I lived in Philadelphia back in the 70s and 80s when the mob in Philly was at its height, and guys like Angelo Bruno and John Stanfa and Nicky Scarfo were making their bones there, and a few miles away in New York, you had people like John Gotti, who nobody knew yet, but he was a star on the rise, mm-hmm. And Salvatore Gravano, who later, colloquially, we call him Sammy the Bull. Mm-hmm. But Salvatore, I understand he hates being called Salvatore, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, and if I ever see him, I'm going to address him as Salvatore, because I don't know what. I just think that this guy's full of shit sometimes. I really do.
He is. He's getting worse by the minute, too.
Yeah. Yeah, we're gonna have to find a way, Lou, to get him on the show.
I don't know if you'd even want him. I mean, he's just like he's a sleazy human being.
Is he?
Yeah, I mean,
he just comes across that way.
Yeah, he's a sleazy human being. He's the worst of that life.
A scumbag, to be honest.
Yeah, he is. He's the worst of that life. The absolute worst of that, what that life ever had to offer, if it had anything to offer. He's the worst of it. There were loyal guys in that life who couldn't kill friends, who wouldn't double cross or stab friends in the back. Yeah. And he was the complete opposite. If he'd kill you in a heartbeat if he could get something out of you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lou Ferranti is the author of this fascinating part one of a 3-part trilogy, Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. Folks, this is the best, but he's got two more that are better. They're coming out. You can pre-order on Amazon.com right now. It is Borgata, Rise of Empire. Lou, you are coming back with me one more time, at least one more time. I'm going to bring it back every month if I can. as long as your schedule holds up, we're good to go. You're going to come back and talk about Kennedy and Hoffa in your next installment with us. But we have to go right now. It is at 8 o'clock, top of the hour, folks, for Louis Ferranti. I am the Mad Dog, Angelo DiCipio. Join us each and every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday for What's the Buzz, America's Best Bobcast. Lou, take care, my friend. Good night. God bless.
Good night, Angelo. Thank you very much. Good night to all your listeners and viewers.